your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. I want to welcome students here. There are students from Bigfoot High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. Tell me, what community is Bigfoot High School in? Pardon me?
What county? Walworth County.
Got it. You may be seated. Welcome from Walworth County. The students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. The Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin have jointly sponsored a program for a number of years, inviting high school students and middle school students to the court to learn about the court procedures. And if the students accept the invitation to come, then they will come to the oral argument. They will have received materials relating to the case they're about to hear. They may have engaged in some activities about the case. And then after this second case, these students meet with the justice assigned to this project for that day and discuss the procedures of the court in accepting and deciding cases. There's no discussion of the substantive issues in the case. And everyone in the courthouse is invited to come and join with the students and the justice. So the first comment is there anyone in the courtroom now who would like a summary of the case we are about to hear? If you do, raise your hand. Okay, we have no takers at the moment. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. She will be the justice with whom you are meeting today. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser, and to his right is Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate left is Justice Pat Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Rogenstack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will now call our second case, 09AP694CR, State versus Ricky R. Denson. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Denson is, how do you pronounce your name, ma'am? Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my esteemed colleagues, and the members of the gallery. My name is Donna Ajewalski, and this morning I represent the defendant appellant petitioner Ricky Denson in this matter. Today, this court has the opportunity to clarify what constitutes a valid waiver of a fundamental constitutional right in a criminal proceeding and identify the appropriate remedy in cases where a valid waiver has not occurred. To unpack that statement a little bit, what I'm asking the court to do today is three things. First, I'm asking this court to extend State versus Weeds' colloquy requirement to encompass the right not to testify at trial. Number two, I'm asking the court to reaffirm that a valid waiver of a fundamental right at a minimum consists of the defendant taking a personal affirmative step on the record indicating the desire to waive a known right. And third, I'm asking the court to hold that where the record does not reflect that the defendant validly waived his right by a personal affirmative act, the proper remedy is a new trial. I'd like to briefly discuss the fundamental nature of the right not to testify and the need for colloquy in that situation. This case presents essentially the flip side of State versus Weed. It's the mirror image. And Weed itself suggests that the right not to testify is a fundamental one.
Counsel, can you state the third premise again that you had, where there's no personal and an affirmative?
Certainly. I'm asking the Court to hold that where the record does not reflect that the defendant validly waived his right by a personal affirmative act, the proper remedy is a new trial.
So where the record does not reflect. In other words, if there is nothing in the record, including no colloquy in the record, then failure to have anything on the record, the remedy for that is a new trial, regardless of whether or not the waiver is knowing or voluntary. In truth.
I actually see the validity of the waiver and the question of whether the waiver was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent as two different issues.
That's right. And which, tell me again, it's failure to have a colloquy you are advancing. It entitles you to a new trial.
I actually failure to have a colloquy, and I want to talk a little bit about this in the context of remedy. The failure to have a colloquy actually is the failure to engage in a conversation with the defendant to get the personal affirmative act on the record. I think that's what the colloquy is designed to do, and I'm happy to address that now, but I intend to address it in my argument later. I do, though, want to address the nature of the right as fundamental. I think that Weed relies on Rock versus Arkansas, and Rock versus Arkansas says that the right that is retained by the defendant is the right to testify or the right to decline to do so. So Rock versus Arkansas and this Court's holding in Weed acknowledges that those rights are mirror images of one another. And so to say that this is symmetry for symmetry's sake, as the State would have us believe, is not acknowledging the nature of the right that Rock versus Arkansas gives or notes that the defendant retains. The right not to testify, it's explicit in the Fifth Amendment right against compelled self-incrimination. It's also implied in the constitutional assurance that the defendant is presumed innocent. And in the trial process, the defendant is entitled to a number of protections that, in fact, bolster the notion that this is a fundamental right. The defendant is entitled to a jury instruction that no inference can be taken from his silence. The prosecutor cannot comment on his silence. And so I think that from a stare decisis standpoint, the extension of Weed to incorporate the right not to testify is a fairly easy thing to do. And to talk about colloquy for a second, this Court has consistently held that where fundamental rights are at stake and where trying to determine whether waiver happened, judicial colloquy with the defendant is the absolute best way to ensure that that right is validly waived. We saw that in Anderson, which dealt with the right to jury trial. We saw that with Klesig in the context of the right to counsel and the right to self-representation, and certainly we saw it again in this Court's opinion in State versus Weed. So what the State is basically asking you to do today is to turn away from that line of cases based on what the State says is persuasive authority from other states, or in the alternative, the State asks this Court to decline to resolve the issue and allow it to be resolved via judicial rulemaking. And I guess I'd like to address the second argument first, and that is this. If this Court has a supervisory authority to mandate colloquies in the context of the right to jury trial, in the context of the right to counsel, and in the mirror image of the right not to testify, it certainly has the authority to do so in this case. And from a judicial efficiency perspective, it really makes no sense to decline the opportunity to do it in this case where the case has been briefed and is currently before the court. I want to address briefly the persuasive authority that's cited by the state.
Can I just ask you something quick?
Sure.
What were all the charges here?
The original charge was first-degree attempt murder, sexual assault of a child, and, negligent handling of a weapon and false imprisonment.
Okay, and is that what he went to trial on?
He went to trial on all four charges. He was acquitted of the negligent handling of a weapon and the sexual assault of a child counts, and he was convicted of a lesser included on the first-degree attempt murder and convicted of false imprisonment. And that actually, those convictions were based in great part on his testimony, which I...
Convictions or the acquittals?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. The acquittals aren't really before this court because he can't be retried on them.
Right, but you're basically saying, put me back in the same position, but I want the benefit of having testified and then not have to testify the next time around, maybe.
Well, I guess it's the question before this court is whether he undertook the benefit of testifying knowing the risks that his testimony could convict him of the counts that he was charged with. And so,
I get what you're saying. I mean, it's a big deal to me, and it was a big deal as a trial court judge to go through that colloquy, and I was probably did it too many times during the trial because they don't have to make up their mind until it really is crunch time at the trial. They can decide to testify, change their mind 5 minutes later, but, you know, there does come a time when they ultimately have to reach that conclusion, consult with their lawyer, and decide if they're going to testify or not. But so in certain respects, you're kind of preaching to the choir. I think that's always the best practice, to really go through it and make sure they know what they're doing and put it on the record. On the other hand, I'm trying to figure out what the right remedy is, because it's not as if he's back in the exact same position that he would have been, you know, had this been done when he was being tried on all the charges. I mean, he'd only go back on a couple.
That's true. But the other side to that argument is that, particularly when we are talking about testimony of the criminal defendant, that particular bell cannot be unrung. So in terms of the impact in this case, he was certainly convicted on the false imprisonment charge because he admitted to the jury that he panicked after this altercation with his girlfriend, and because he panicked, he wasn't thinking clearly, and so took her into the basement and tied her there. And again, I guess I want to go back to, and I'll address this really more clearly in remedy, but I think that the colloquy itself is designed to keep us from having to be right where we are. And
I don't disagree with you. So what you're saying is that structural error, if a judge doesn't do it, that's the end of the analysis. You go back and you get to try the counts that you were convicted of.
I wouldn't.
Right?
I guess I would say that I really look at it in terms of whether there was a valid waiver of a fundamental constitutional right. And if there was no valid waiver, then the cases are clear that no valid waiver equals a new trial.
And I'm not going to monopolize your time, but the only way you say that we can determine if there's a valid waiver is to look at the colloquy with the judge.
I think what I'm asking you to look at is whether there was a personal affirmative act on the part of the defendant, because I think that is what the colloquy is designed to do, is to draw out the act of the defendant, either in writing or in oral, in court, in open court, to have the conversation with the defendant to say, Mr. Defendant, do you understand that you have this right not to testify? Do you understand that nothing can be taken from your silence? And do you understand that only you can make that decision, not your defense attorney, not me, but only you? And the answer is, whether it's done via a form where that is signed by the defendant or whether it is done by a colloquy in open court, there must be, under the law as I see it, some personal affirmative act. And the reason for that is that we do not allow waiver to happen via agents, particularly not in the context of fundamental constitutional rights.
Counsel. You're relying on the Weeks case. Weeks said that, Weed said that there's a constitutional right of a criminal defendant to testify. It's fundamental, right? Now, this is the opposite of that.
Correct.
It's a right not to testify.
Correct.
Right? And you want us to say it's fundamental.
Correct.
Okay. We said then that the circuit court should conduct an on-the-record colloquy to ensure the defendant is knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waiving his right to testify.
Correct.
You want the court to say that a circuit court should conduct an on-the-record colloquy to ensure that the defendant is knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waiving his or her right not to testify.
Correct.
Right. We then goes on to say the circuit court didn't conduct a colloquy. Did the circuit court conduct a colloquy here?
No.
Okay.
There
so
was
we're
no colloquy.
Right on target with Weed.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely. And I guess in Weed, this court acknowledged that though apparently the remedy was appropriate, a post-conviction evidentiary hearing was appropriate in Weed, this court acknowledged that there might be cases where that remedy would be inappropriate.
Okay. That's the one I was going to get to next. So the fourth holding on this was reviewing the record and reviewing the post-conviction hearing. We agree with the circuit court that Weed, it's a question of law, right?
Right.
Knowingly, intelligently, and waived a right to testify. But you don't want us to say that you can have a post-conviction hearing and then make a determination for intelligently, voluntarily, and waiving a right not to testify. Do I have your argument down?
Actually, if I could address remedy, I think that my argument will become a little more clear. When we turn to remedy, in a way to do that makes sense looking at the cases, is to look at the purpose of the colloquy. Okay? We talk about colloquies, and we talk about judicial efficiency and how that would save time and protect rights, but the real purpose of the colloquy, as I said, the cases say, is that in the context of waiver, it's there to be prophylactic. It's to ensure that the waiver of the right is valid on the record and personally made by the defendant. And when we look at the issue of the waiver, it's important to understand what makes a waiver valid based on what this court has done before. And the principles that I take away that I think are pretty fundamental in context of waiver is that, number one, non-waiver is presumed. So we cannot presume waiver. Number two, we cannot presume waiver from a defendant's silence. And that is certainly what we have here. And number three, waiver cannot occur via the statements of an agent, such as defense counsel. So what Anderson and Livingston taken together really give us is that a valid waiver, at a minimum, requires a personal affirmative act by the defendant at the time of the waiver, showing the defendant's intention to give up a known right. Because that's what Johnson versus Zerfs tells us, an intentional relinquishment of a known right.
Could I ask, what happened at trial? Did the state complete its case?
The state completed its case.
And then did the defense put on a case?
The defense did put on a case, and there were other witnesses, but the primary witness for the defense was Mr. Denson. And it's interesting to talk about what happened at trial in the context of remedy, and I think it shows why the remedy isn't sufficient in this case. We did have a post-conviction evidentiary hearing in this case because Jaramillo said we once I raise it, then the court is required to have a hearing, and we had one. And what was interesting was that the testimony of Mr. Denson and his trial counsel aligned in a really significant way, and that is that they both testified that they agreed that to put on the defense Mr. Denson requested, Mr. Denson would have to testify. Okay? There were no other witnesses to the actual incident itself. So to put on the defense that Mr. Denson wanted to have, he would have to testify. Regarding Mr. Denson's understanding of his right not to testify, it's not clear by a long shot that he understood that he had the right not to testify. And looking at what the testimony was at the post-conviction hearing makes that very clear. Mr. Hauer said he couldn't recall discussing the jury instructions regarding the defendant's silence. Mr. Denson didn't recall that either. Mr. Hauer did recall discussing the nature of the right not to testify, but that doesn't, again, we cannot presume waiver, and waiver cannot occur via an agent. And so what Mr. Howard told Mr. Denson may go to the question of whether his waiver was knowing, voluntary, or intelligent, but it does not go to whether the waiver was valid. In other words, it doesn't go to whether the waiver was on the record and made by Mr. Denson himself.
Did Mr. Howard, the defense attorney, do something like this? Your Honor, the defense calls, what's his name, Ricky Denson, the defendant Ricky Denson. What happened?
That's essentially what happened. Mr. Howard said the defense calls Mr. Denson, and Mr. Denson got up to the stand and testified. Now, I have to say, this trial occurred in 2003. And so we are at a place, 2004. And so we're at a place where the weed requirement was in existence, but, he was testifying, the weed colloquy was not undertaken either.
Okay. So, but did Mr. Howard ask questions of the defendant?
Certainly.
Okay. Was this a surprise to the defendant?
No, and if the court is asking whether Mr. Denson's personal affirmative act was testifying, as I think it might be, the answer is that's not a valid waiver.
Aren't you really saying that a defendant who is represented by counsel and who is called by counsel to testify, it is absolutely worthless to have counsel present because somehow the relationship between defense counsel and the defendant cannot be relied on. We have to go to the court to get that affirmative expression that the defendant wants to testify. I mean, it seems to me this is so minimizing the role of counsel. It's almost ludicrous.
I don't think it's minimizing the role of counsel at all. I think what it does is it clarifies the record on appeal. Because what we are doing now, what we are forced to do when there is not a colloquy on the record at the time that the waiver is made, is that we're trying to reconstruct the alleged waiver, sometimes months, sometimes years after the fact. We're relying on recollections of trial counsel and the defendant. And in this case, the recollections weren't even supported by his files because his files were destroyed in a flood. So we're looking at 5 years later, a post-conviction hearing in which trial counsel is recalling from memory his discussions about the right not to testify, and Mr. Denson is recalling his recollections. And again, it's not about the relationship between the attorney and the defendant, the defense attorney and the defendant. I agree that that's a crucial relationship, but this is more about making sure that the record is clear on appeal. And I'm asking the court to add three sentences to an existing colloquy, and from a judicial efficiency perspective, that makes perfect sense. This court already requires a colloquy in the context of the right not right to testify. If we add three more sentences, then we've clarified the record, and we aren't in this position to have to reconstruct. So essentially, I think this court is basically, what I'm asking the court to do is to understand and acknowledge that waiver colloquies are designed to get that personal affirmative act of the defendant on the record so that we're not reconstructing a waiver where one did not happen on the record. So really what I'm asking the court to do is to reaffirm the central holding in Livingston and Anderson, which is where there's no personal affirmative act by the defendant on the record at the time he waives the fundamental right, there's no valid waiver.
Counsel, what are the words you want us to add? What are the words you want us to add and require of circuit judges?
I would actually like the circuit judge to, in discussing the right to testify or not to testify, to basically say, you understand you have the right not to testify in addition to the right to testify. You understand that no inferences can be made from your silence, and do you understand that only you can make the decision to testify or not to testify? And based on your understanding, what is your decision today? And then there is a yes or no answer. It is on the record. It is clear so that a reviewing court can see that the waiver was personally made and affirmatively made by the defendant.
And you don't think that defendants at this point, when there's a weed colloquy and they're being told you have the right to testify, that they don't understand that that must mean you also have the right not to testify? You think that has to be spelled out?
I think it's more important to spell it out and make sure that everyone understands what the rights are. Otherwise, we are presuming that they understand that they have a right. We're presuming from silence, and the cases do not allow us to presume from silence.
You think that this requirement would be one that would be retroactive?
I did not brief the issue of retroactivity. I know that the state would like for this to be prospective only. I guess what I can say is that I certainly did not brief it. I know that in this case, the remedy of an evidentiary hearing was insufficient for the reasons that I set forth. And again, we're not talking about a deficient colloquy. And there's another distinction that can be made that I want to make sure that I address to the court. Klesig and Imani, when we talk about those two cases, in Klesig and Imani, there were valid waivers, but there were deficient colloquies. And by that, I mean, if you look at Klesig and Imani, both Mr. Klesig and Mr. Imani they had a personal affirmative act on the record indicating their desire to represent themselves and give up their right to counsel. Mr. Klesig did it via letter and in open court on the record. Mr. Imani did it on the record in open court. Now, the colloquies were deficient. The court did not engage in the lines of inquiry that Klesig require. But, and as I said, in those cases, it's appropriate to look retrospectively at the parameters of what the defendant was giving up, because we have a statement on the record that the defendant knew he was giving up a right. In this case, where there's no colloquy, there's no personal affirmative act, and thus there is no assurance that there is a valid waiver. I just want to go back. Oh, and my time is up.
Counsel, Justice Bradley had a question.
I'll wait until rebuttal. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Well, I was looking at SM 28 from the Wisconsin Jury Instructions Criminal. They provide under weed, they say you have to do the following things, but they also add, and do you understand you have a constitutional right not to testify? And then they have, as you suggest, that do you understand the decision whether to testify is for you to make? That would fit with what you said.
Right.
They don't have the line you have suggested, which is no inference will be made from your silence. Is that right?
I think that's a fair summary of what is retained when one keeps that right.
I would like you to think back, and you may or may not have this, but this reminds me much of Bangert.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And my recollection, which I did not check against the case law, is Bangert reversed another case. And in that case, the court said, hey, you don't have a colloquy, and I may be stating this inaccurately. If you don't have a colloquy, it's a do-over. And Bangert said, no, you don't have a colloquy, or you have a defective, well, you have Bangert in the other cases. Either no colloquy or defective colloquy, you're going to get not a do-over, but you're going to get a hearing on whether or not you voluntarily, intelligently waived your whatever right we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question to you is twofold, which I'd like you to answer on your way back here. One, you're changing, quote, the remedy that has been, quote, traditional in Bangert and in Klesig and other cases. So on what grounds do you do that? Why is this different than these other cases? And now I've forgotten my other brilliant suggestion of what you should address, but it'll come to me, and you will not have the benefit of thinking about it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Maura F.J. Whalen, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court, I am A.G. Maura Whalen for the state. I first wanted to just quickly address the Denson's argument about the specific post-conviction hearing that occurred in this case.
I'm going to interrupt you. My question to you that I wanted to pose is, you are right that in Weed, the court said there could be cases that, I'm going to call it a Mockney hearing, a evidentiary hearing is not sufficient. I want to know the details of when it's not sufficient. Sorry.
Okay.
Ms. Whalen.
I was very surprised to hear counsel discussing the deficiencies that she sees in the post-conviction hearing that actually took place in this case. I believe that part of the case has been waived and is not before the court. As I argued in the state's response brief, the court's credibility determinations, the circuit court's credibility determinations, which were that the defense counsel was more credible than Denson at the post-conviction hearing, are reviewable only for erroneous exercise of discretion, and that Denson at no time has ever argued or suggested that those credibility findings were erroneous. And indeed, I went on to argue that they clearly weren't erroneous, but I don't think that I should have to further defend that hearing at this time. And also, just one more thing on this issue, even though we presented that argument in the brief in chief, the reply brief was totally, Denson's reply brief was totally silent about the adequacy of that post-conviction hearing. So I really do not think that that issue is before the court.
Well, the issue, as you stated, may not be whether this particular hearing should be overturned, but the issue before the court is whether any hearing is going to be a sufficient, right?
Exactly. And okay. That, it was my assumption, was the reason that Denson did not take on the issue was because Denson believes it's it's the wrong remedy, so therefore I don't have to see if the remedy was adequate in this part. And I wanted to just respond for a couple of minutes about the remedy. At the end of argument today and in the reply brief, Denson argued that there should be a distinction in remedy depending on whether the court's failure to conduct a mandated colloquy is complete or partial. A post-conviction evidentiary hearing is sufficient for partial failures, he argues, but a new trial is necessary for complete failures. I do not believe that this dichotomy exists in the case law. Moreover, in the colloquy context, and this is the important point I really want to make, it's illogical to link the remedy to the extent of the circuit court's failure to meet the requirement. A constitutionally based colloquy is a prophylactic device intended to protect the defendant's constitutional right. The colloquy is not an end in itself and is not treasured for its own sake. Therefore, it's illogical to base the remedy on whether the court's failure was complete or partial. Either way, the fundamental question is the same. Did the defendant validly waive his constitutional right? That question should be answered in a post-conviction evidentiary hearing. If the court determines at that hearing that the defendant did not validly waive his constitutional right, then he will be entitled to a new trial.
Now, in the Bangert example, and maybe it's a mistake for me to look at Bangert.
I don't think so.
Okay. In the Bangert example, the defect in the colloquy, as I remember it, and again, I didn't go back and look at these cases again, the defect in the colloquy would affect whether or not you automatically got a hearing, post-conviction hearing, or you had to have adequate grounds to get a hearing. Am I right in my recollection?
Yeah, you have to both allege, I mean, this has to do with the allegations
right.
in post-conviction mm-hmm. motion, I think you're saying, was this a fully good colloquy, and did you not know what you were doing? Both.
That was if it's a perfect colloquy.
Right.
If it's
right.
not a perfect colloquy, you automatically get a hearing.
And you make the other allegations
right.
about. And of course, Bangert is more complicated than any of the subsequent cases, including today's case, because Bangert, the waiver of the guilty plea waiver has, I don't know, maybe 10 constitutional rights you're waiving. So there are a lot of hoops that the circuit court really has to go through to make sure that that's a valid waiver.
Yeah, but it seems to me the same rules apply here. That is, the reason you make the court go through the hoops is
yeah.
because you want to assure that the defendant knows what the defendant is doing, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I just meant, I think that what we saw in Bangert was a partial colloquy, and the reason, and it was just one where there are more, a greater number of questions.
Right.
That's all.
Chance of the trial court making a mistake or greater.
Perhaps. And I wanted to address today's new argument, which is presenting a dichotomy talking about a personal affirmative act. And this is new in Denson's argument. And he takes it from the Livingston case and Anderson's allusion to the Livingston case. And I think that there's a lot of confusion here about what Livingston in particular is about. I had argued in the state's response brief that the Livingston new trial remedy is distinguishable from the post-conviction hearing remedy because that's a case where the statute says no without a on-the-record or written waiver, you have to have a jury trial. It's just that is written into the statute. So if there's no written or on-the-record waiver, there has to be a jury trial, and you get a new trial if you didn't make a statutorily authorized waiver. Now, the language about the defendant's personal waiver of his right, that language is in Livingston and the prior Krieger, is about the defendant personally waiving his right to a jury trial, and that without a personal waiver of the right to a jury trial, there is no waiver of the right to a jury trial. It's not a matter of whether that waiver was knowing or intelligent or voluntary. It's a matter of whether it even happened. And if the lawyer makes the waiver, it's not a waiver at all because it's not a personal waiver. There's just no waiver. And so we look to Rizzio, which is prior to Livingston, and Anderson, which is post-Livingston, where the defendant did make a waiver, an actual personal waiver. The question was, okay, sure he did that waiver, but was it voluntary, intelligent, and knowing? And in order to determine whether it was voluntary, intelligent, and knowing, we have a post-conviction hearing. We have a new trial to only when the guy, in fact, didn't waive at all. Only his lawyer waived, but his lawyer doesn't get to waive.
Counsel, I've been trying to get a better flavor for the particular defendant here, Ricky Denson, and you know, it troubles me if you've got somebody who just doesn't know their rights and they're forced to go to trial or they're at trial and they don't know that they have a choice to testify or not. That's not right. I mean, they have the constitutional right to testify. They have the constitutional right to not testify, and they need to understand that. But as I look through the file here, you know, it looks like Mr. Denson had a number of attorneys, maybe even five. He was listed on the witness list as a witness. The jury instructions have that bracketed portion that talks about whether or not a defendant testifies, and then the judge either gives that or not. The file is thick with handwritten, detailed case citing motions for mandamus, motions in limine, motions, a variety of motions that the defendant wrote to the court. So he was one of those frequent writers, and, you know, they make sense, actually. His motions make a lot of sense, and they cite case law. I'm trying to figure out what his prior experience was in the judicial. Is this his first go-around? Had he ever had a trial before? If I looked him up on CCAP, would I find that he had trials where he did or didn't testify? Because, I mean, that's all public record, so that's fair game.
Sure.
Any idea?
I'm sorry.
They even, by the way, brought a motion to sever twice, at least in part on the basis that if he's forced to defend against all these counts together, it puts him in a bad position because he wants to testify for some and not others. So, you know, I'm trying to figure out, is this somebody who just really didn't know what was going on and he didn't know his rights? Or does the record speak for itself and are these writings things the court ought to consider as well as the testimony?
Well, in fact, the circuit court did consider those things. I don't know if the circuit court looked at them with the same care that you obviously did, but and I quote this in the brief, that the circuit court noted that Denson had been a very active defendant and filed frequent pro se motions and pleadings on his own behalf, and colorfully said that Mr. Denson is not shy about stating his opinions about things, including in court and to professionals. I also wanted to follow up on your earlier question, which was something that I did not think of, but in a case like this where he won, let's say, sort of one and a half of the charges because one was reduced to a lesser-included offense, that's a very dramatic additional reason that post-conviction hearing rather than a new trial is the proper remedy here. And it's sort of like, you know, well, I'll go through these charges, and then I'll see what's left, and then I'll go have another trial, and then I'll see what's left. Maybe I'll get rid of the attempted murder completely, and then maybe I can get another trial on the remaining thing. I mean, I think that alone, apart from anything that the state has argued previously and the other similar case law, I just think that observation really dramatically shows that post-conviction hearing is the right solution unless we could somehow get around double jeopardy and say a new trial is a totally new trial. But I'm not prepared to figure that out right now.
Go ahead, Dave, Justice Breslin.
Was Mr. Denson taking medication?
That I do not know.
How could there be a colloquy if we didn't know whether he was taking medication and if he'd gotten his medication that day? And what was his level of education so that he'd understand the question? Don't we have to go into all of these things if we're going to replicate the Bangert hearing and Bangert colloquy?
Well, that...
Because it's perfectly useless to have defense counsel right there, according to this.
Mm-hmm. Well, that actually, I don't know the answer to those questions. And I think that by posing the question, you raise kind of the implicit question, which is that is the stripped-down SM-28 proposal or Denson's kind of brief stripped-down proposal, is that really the kind of colloquy that would solve the alleged problem? Or do we have to, because if the idea is that defense counsel has not helped the defendant prepare in any way for the fact that he's going to testify, for example, does the court have to say, well, do you know you're going to be cross-examined? Do you know you're going to have your prior convictions presented? How far should or must the judge be required to go to ascertain that there's an adequate waiver? And if we don't require the judge to go all the way, well, is there, and I think this is your point, is there any point to the colloquy? And this is a lot of why we urge that the question be addressed in rulemaking, because these sort of bigger picture questions can I think be more fully addressed in that kind of proceeding.
Well, you don't want them asked in the colloquy, but don't you want them asked in the post-conviction motion? Do you want to do away with the post-conviction motion?
Oh, yeah, I think you would ask all those things in the post.
Okay, so you're going to ask whether he's on drugs.
Sure.
You're going to ask about his education in post-conviction. So it's the state's position, do all that at post-conviction. You don't need any colloquy to begin with. So you'd rather have a double procedure rather than get rid of it all in the first procedure. That's the state's position, as I hear it.
That this may come across that way. The state
How
actually...
How does it not come across that way, Ms. Whalen?
The state's position on whether there should be a colloquy for this particular waiver of this particular right is actually a neutral position.
Well, I didn't read your brief that way, so let's... that's why I'm asking this question. It seems
sure.
to me the first question about whether there should be a colloquy is a question of law, and it's unrelated to the facts of this particular case.
I agree.
Either we're going to have a colloquy about the right to not testify, or we're not going to have a colloquy.
Mm-hmm.
So the facts and this particular defendant are irrelevant. As I read your brief on page 2, and I'll just read the big type part. The court should not use its supervisory authority to mandate an on-the-record colloquy by the trial court to ensure that a defendant's waiver of his right not to testify is knowing and voluntary. And that you do right up through page 8. And you wind up that if we're going to require a colloquy, we should do it in formal rulemaking, not in a case.
Mm-hmm.
And that we should not extend weed as a matter of law. That is still your position.
Correct. And our position has to do with the method for deciding.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry.
It has to do with the
method or the means that you follow to impose or mandate the colloquy. It's not so it's neutral in that We are not opposing nor endorsing the colloquy.
How would you appear at a rulemaking hearing?
How would I? I'm sorry.
How would you appear? When I say how, what would the state's position be at a rulemaking hearing?
Okay. I didn't understand that. I guess I can't say because
that's right.
I can't say because, and I think that maybe I should back up and say who I imagine would be at the rulemaking. I mean, not besides all of you. I think the most important stakeholders would be trial defense counsel and secondarily trial judges. Although I note that's probably less important than it might be otherwise because we have four trial judges here, but I think trial judges who have already worked with SM 28 as it is currently drafted by the Jury Instructions Committee and who could testify about, you know, this colloquy is great. And it has been great, and I don't know what anybody's problems are have against it. Or they might be saying, as I think Justice Prosser was implying, well, it's sort of pointless because it doesn't even address the specific issues. So anyway, and then other, and then also I think we would want to hear from the DAs and my office and the appellate defense branch, and I think that the appellate branch on either side or on both sides would, and we would have to study this. That's why I can't just speak off the cuff. We would have to study our files, I think, both defense and prosecutions, and see, is this a solution in search of a problem or not? I mean, and so that's why we think getting all of these voices together in a rulemaking is preferable to imposing this colloquy in case adjudication.
You agree that the right not to testify or the right to testify are both substantive rights?
Yeah, I agree completely. They're fundamental rights.
And under our rulemaking in 750.12, we have limitations about dealing with substantive rights. Whereas in cases, we deal with substantive rights all the time.
Right, but you...
So we have a real issue as to whether or not, when we put in a colloquy, we're dealing with a substantive right, or we're not dealing with a substantive right.
Well, actually, I don't think so, because what we're not talking today... I mean, we're all agreeing that these substantive rights exist. We're not talking about creating a substantive right. We are merely talking about creating a prophylactic requirement to protect the substantive right. And so...
You think that's rules of process, procedure?
Yeah, I think so.
Practice?
I believe so.
Counsel, you don't disagree with defense counsel here that the better practice clearly would have been for the judge to go through a colloquy, right? At least you're going to have a hard time with me if you think the better practice isn't to do that, because I did that all the time, and I think most judges do that. It's important to try to make the best record you can, but
sometimes
things happen, and now we're dealing with it on appeal.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
in our case law and otherwise, we make recommendations, best practices or ideas or a better way to have done this. But we wouldn't be here today, probably, if the judge would have gone through a colloquy.
Well, that's true. And that's the case in almost every case I have that, you know, if the DA or defense counsel or the judge had done something slightly differently, we wouldn't have this case and I wouldn't have a job. But
that doesn't always require a rulemaking hearing.
Counsel, help me with this. You've acknowledged it's the best practice to have a colloquy with regard to this, I think you termed, fundamental right.
I don't think I acknowledge that, but...
Okay, you didn't... whatever you did. Everyone heard it, so that's fine. My question is this. It seems to me that the law is clear that the waiver of a fundamental right has to be knowing
and voluntary. Am I right? Am I correct
yes.
on that? So we have to have evidence, or we have to be able to demonstrate that the waiver of a fundamental right is knowing and voluntary. It seems to me that we can either do that in a colloquy, or we can do that in a post-evidentiary hearing, which I will, for shorthand, say a Banger-like hearing.
Sure.
If we don't do it in a colloquy, it has to be then done in a Banger-like hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Well,
if there's an issue, how else do you resolve it, either at the time or after the time, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Although I would just point out that even with a colloquy, there could still be a post-conviction.
Sure. But without a colloquy addressing it,
mm-hmm.
and without any demonstration anywhere at the time that there was a knowing and voluntary waiver of a fundamental right, it then has to be demonstrated after the fact at an evidentiary hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Am I wrong or am I right on that? And then what is the advantage of requiring the contest to exist after the hearing, after the time that the right is waived, as opposed to at the time? Cost-benefit analysis.
Oh, okay. Well, again, I'm not opposing the colloquy. I'm remaining neutral on that and saying, yeah, okay.
Okay.
But
let's
I think that that these are the kinds of points and observations that suggest that the colloquy may be a proper solution if there really is a problem. And but our position is simply that should be done in rulemaking rather than case adjudication.
Okay.
Where
I
our
understand
position
your
is
position.
Really neutral on...
Do you have authority to respond to what's the cost-benefit analysis? That is, does it sound like it's better to try to deal with it at the colloquy, or does it sound like it's better to deal with whether or not the waiver was voluntary and knowing at a post-evidentiary hearing? Or don't you have the authority to wade into that?
Well, I don't think I have any authority because I think that that's a factual question, and we have to know how much of a problem it is. I will certainly agree that on its face, it's certain that certainly has the appeal of being persuasive. I mean, but whether it's the right decision or not, I'm not sure. And I just want to point out that, I mean, as acknowledged in Weed, Weed is in the minority jurisdictions that adopt the Weed side of the colloquy, and I haven't found anyone who adopts what I'll call the Denson side of the colloquy, although they may be out there. This is a kind of a difficult issue to research. You get hundreds of false hits. So anyway, but the reason, particularly the federal courts, have rejected both sides of the question has to do with concerns about the intrusion into the attorney-client relationship, and that the defendant's decision whether or not to testify is obviously crucial and central and important to his case. But for that very reason, the input and advice he gets from defense counsel is crucial and central and important to the defense counsel function and their relationship. And so, therefore, I think it behooves the court to tread lightly into the area of that relationship. And that's, again, why we urge rulemaking.
Counsel, it doesn't seem to make a difference whether we say, trial court, thou shall have a colloquy, or trial court, the better practice is to have a colloquy. If we say, thou shall have a colloquy, although the state doesn't want us to say it, if we say it, the state's position is if there's an error in the colloquy, either it's not given at all or it's erroneously given, you have a post-conviction remedy. If, on the other hand, we say it's better practice, and the trial court, again, just omits it or erroneously gives it, you have a post-conviction remedy. So for the state's position, regardless of whether the court is silent about a colloquy, mandates a colloquy, suggests a colloquy, the answer always is, if there's an error in this colloquy, you have post-conviction. So it shouldn't make any difference to the state. Now, should it make any difference to the trial court? No. Because if it's mandated, it doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter to the defendant either, if you take the state's position. Because no matter what the court does, you always have a post-conviction remedy. So it's back to the same question that I asked and Justice Bradley asked somewhat differently, that is it better to at least try and do it right the first time in the trial and avoid the post-conviction remedy, or just save the time at the trial and just do it afterwards?
Well,
you may disagree with my analysis.
Well, yeah, no, I'd like to respond to that. From your question, I see that there are three different kinds of post-conviction motions, depending on, you know, whether there's your silent mandate or suggest. In all three of those post-conviction motions, the defendant has to allege that he didn't know what he was doing, that he didn't know that he could waive his right not to testify. And in a mandated world, he'd also have to allege that there was no colloquy. And in a best practices world, he'd also, I think, have to allege that. So I think his allegations would be different, but even with a colloquy, he can still allege,
absolutely,
yeah, there was a colloquy, but I didn't know.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So he's, in a way, and I'll just finish, because I see I'm on red, the post-conviction world and the appellate world is not in that different a situation, as long as this defendant can said, colloquy or no colloquy, I didn't know that.
Harder to do after a colloquy, and it's harder for the defendant, just like with Miranda rights, harder for the defendant to say, I didn't know. That's the point. You have a colloquy, that becomes a very difficult issue for the defendant to overcome. It's a pro-state position, whether you recognize it or neutral. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Odrowski.
I want to address your issue with respect to Bangert, because I think Bangert is an excellent example of this scenario. We talk about colloquies and in the context of plea waivers, and the interesting thing about the colloquies there is that they are actually in the circuit courts guided by a client acknowledgement and waiver of rights form, which is...
Is that the questionnaire?
That's the questionnaire that's signed by the defendant. And it lists all of the rights that the defendant is giving up when he makes a plea of guilty. And it is used as a guideline by circuit courts to go through when they are engaging in that colloquy, which is also required by statute. But basically,
It's a guideline for the court to use. But there is, with that questionnaire, a personal affirmative act, a signature at the bottom of a form saying, I know about these rights. I have heard about these rights. I am giving them up. Now, we have a personal affirmative act, and if there's allegations that the criminal defendant did not understand those rights that he was validly waiving by signing the form and going through the plea questionnaire process, then certainly the appropriate remedy is a post-conviction hearing to look at the record to see, was that waiver knowing, intelligent, and voluntary? Because there was a waiver. It was on the record. It was on the record not only orally, but in writing. And the question then becomes, what did the defendant know, and when did he know it? And at that point, then the defense counsel's input is crucial. Because, yes, then we can look to see what the defendant understood from many different sources. We can look at the record. We can look at the questionnaire. We can look at the colloquy between the judge and the defendant. We can take testimony from the defense counsel. We can look to that. But there is a personal affirmative act on the record. It's oral, on the record. And if the colloquy with the court is deficient, then we can look retrospectively. But, for example, let's say there wasn't a form signed, and there was just an entry of judgment. I don't think there's any question here that there wouldn't be a personal affirmative act by the defendant, and there wouldn't be a valid waiver. And that's what I'm saying. The colloquy is designed to be prophylactic. It's designed to put into place a system by which we get that affirmative act on the record. But it's not the end-all, be-all. And so what I'm saying is that I can envision situations in which there is a lack of a colloquy between the trial court and the defendant, but there's been a valid waiver by the signing of a form. Now, that's entirely possible.
I want to deal with the Bangert case and a predecessor case, Caccini. Fun to say. At any rate, in Caccini, we held that a trial court violates a defendant's right to due process when it fails to ascertain the defendant's understanding of the nature of the charge on the record at the time of the plea hearing. And we eschewed Caccini.
I'm just having a great time
this morning. We eschewed Caccini and Ernst and said, hey, we back away from that. And that seems to be the very argument you're making, that the failure to have a colloquy results in the remedy of a new trial or a plea withdrawal because it's a violation of due process. And instead, we backed away from that kind of language in Ernst and Caccini and said, hey, you still have to have a colloquy because, of course, the statute mandates a personal colloquy. But now it seems to me our cases, including Banger, Anderson is a good example also. In Anderson, we talk about what's the remedy. And the remedy is you have an evidentiary hearing. So why isn't that the remedy here? Why would it be the new trial that you would start? Aren't you just redoing Caccini?
If I'm recalling correctly, I'm looking at Anderson here. If I'm recalling correctly, there was a personal affirmative act in Anderson. There was a signature on a form.
That's referenced in paragraph 25. That's right. There's a reference to that in Livingston. I don't read.
I guess my point is this. The notion of the colloquy isn't for the purpose of having the colloquy itself. What we're trying to do there is to make sure that the record is clear. And if the record is clear without a colloquy, that the defendant made a personal affirmative act waiving a right that he knew about, then I think that the appropriate remedy
is to determine whether the waiver was knowing, intelligent, or voluntary. But when we don't have the defendant making that statement, I think we are at a place where the waiver is invalid. And where there's an invalid waiver, the remedy is clear. It's a new trial. I do want to just briefly take up
– two sentences left.
I would ask Justice Ziegler, if you can find anywhere in Mr. Denson's writings, speaking, anywhere where Mr. Denson indicated he understood that he had a right not to testify and that he understood that he was giving that right up, then I would agree that that we could use that to determine whether his waiver was valid. But
even
I
if it was years prior?
Pardon me?
Even if it was years prior?
No. I think that we need to address it in the case where he's waiving the right.
Okay.
But I would say that if, again, just like in Klesig and in Imani, if the defendant says, I know I have this right, I want to give it up, then the parameters of the right can be fleshed in via post-conviction hearing. But where there is no waiver, where the defendant does not make that express voluntary act on the record, then a new trial is required. You can't unring the bell of testimony. You just cannot.
Are there any further questions? If not, I want to thank both counsel for excellent arguments and briefs today on a continuing issue of the obligations of a trial court to guarantee to defendants their constitutional rights, and yet have trial courts able to work under conditions of many cases and not have everything overturned for defects in procedures. So that ends our hearing on 09-AP-694-CR, State versus Denson. The court is in recess until 1:30. Justice Bradley will be up momentarily to talk with the students. We are in recess.